Hey, speaking of soccer, Eric, you're not on the big soccer bus, are you?
I am not on the big soccer bus. I will be following the score in the game against Iran today. I think it's going to be interesting. But I'm not going to be spending any time watching it. I can watch the highlights if there are any goals scored, which is always a possibility in big time soccer, I guess. But no, I was reacting in my newsletter today, and it's online. I just go to ericzorn.substack.com. You can read my commentary, and it's sort of an answer to what Laura Washington wrote in the Tribune yesterday, which is a version of columns that I have seen for the last 40 years, maybe, talking about how soccer is the future. Her column said yesterday, you know, soccer is the place to be, and the Chicago Fire, if the Bears leave town, the Chicago Fire is going to be the Soldier Field's marquee tenant. Soccer is hot, she says. You know, the fans are crowding into neighborhood bars to cheer on their teams. And then she says, you know, at the end, she writes, "Bye bye, Bears. Soccer is Chicago's future." And I just roll my eyes at that kind of stuff. Soccer has been the sport of the future for as long as I can remember, and it will always be the sport of the future in the United States. Our sports fans just aren't going to fall in love with soccer the way they've fallen in love with American football or even baseball, basketball. It's always going to be a second-tier sport. And these people who are, you know, soccer boosters continually try to tell us. It really reminds me of the people who tell us about how superior the metric system is and how the United States is going to adopt the metric system. That's not going to happen either. And you don't even really have to argue the merits of the various games. You know, whether is soccer a better game than baseball or basketball or football? I don't think so, but it doesn't really matter what I think. I think, you know, there's plenty of room out there for people to have various opinions on sports, various sporting interests. I like to watch golf on TV, and people think that's really boring. So I get the fact that not everyone's tastes are the same, but just the idea that this is going to sweep the nation and the World Cup fever means that that next year people are going to go out to Soldier Field to watch the Chicago Fire play. You know, one of the things that Laura doesn't seem to acknowledge is that if you go to a Chicago Fire game, you're going to kind of have your pick of seats. They averaged a little under 16,000 fans this past season. And the stadium, Soldier Field, holds about 61,000 people. So it's not really taken off. And again, we are decades away from, remember the women won the World Cup and everyone was like, soccer's going to be the new thing. And it just isn't going to happen. I mean, tell me I'm wrong.
I think you're ignoring the fact that the population of the country is changing, and that as we do get more multi-ethnic, as we do get more Hispanic, that tide will sweep in more fans for the sport. I understand your point, but I also think there's a little predictability to what you're saying, because as long as people have been saying soccer is the next big thing, there are these Americans who don't seem to have any appreciation for what the world is also doing. They almost seem to be resistant to it. Like, I'm not going to do soccer because that's not our sport. And I think it's coming. And maybe it's not coming as quickly as some of these people have been predicting, but I do think there is some inevitability to it. The world is all linked together, Eric.
The world's linked together, but I would think there's a better chance that American-style football will catch on overseas than there is that their style. I mean, the thing is, I find the game, I like watching soccer highlights. There's some great soccer highlight reels, and those athletes are incredible.
Amazing.
And what they do, you know, they do their backflip bicycle kicks into the goal. It's stunning what they can do. But most of the game is kicking the ball back and forth. You have these games. Like the other day I watched, my son was in town. He's a little bit more of a soccer fan than I am. So we had the U.S. England game going. And they kicked the ball around the field for 98 minutes or whatever it was. And nobody scored a goal. And people in England were really upset. And people in America were pretty happy. And I don't know. I didn't really catch my interest that much. I like a little more scoring in my game. I understand why a 0-0 game is beautiful. Baseball fans will tell you that a 1-0 shutout is a great thing to watch. I'm a little more spoiled than that. I guess I like to see a little more scoring action.
What do you think the average score is of a World Cup final game? I looked this up yesterday. What is the average score of a World Cup final?
I'm going to say final or just these World Cup matches you're talking about?
I don't know that there'd be a big difference, but what I saw was final.
Average, I'd say 3-2. Is that close?
1-0.
1-0. Okay. All right. Well, then, maybe I should rest my case there. I mean, I just don't think there's enough scoring. And, of course, there was also indoor soccer that was supposed to be the big thing because it had a lot more scoring. The goal was bigger. The indoor field was so much smaller that they had more goals. You have like these games where the score was 11-9 or something, but even that didn't really catch fire. You know, you might be right about the fact that there are the country is becoming, you know, there are more Hispanic people here, there are more immigrants coming, and that they do love the game. I still don't think that it's going to really catch on here the way we've been told it's going to. The idea is that, well, all these little kids, every little kid, my kids, I'm sure your kids, all play soccer when they're little, and then they just to grow up into soccer fans, and that just doesn't seem to happen for the most part. I mean, they may be a little bit more interested in it, but they transfer their allegiance to football, which, I mean, I would argue that football, U.S. football, is just an amazingly good game. I know it's got problems with the brain injuries and so on, and there are all kinds of issues with it, but just as a pure sport, as a game, it is so fascinating for me to watch. Now, and maybe that's American-centric of me, but just the way every play is like a chess match between the offensive coaches and the defensive coaches. And after every play, you get to sit there and analyze what happened. And there's plenty of scoring in American football. And I just think it's an incredible game of wits and speed and luck. And it's really a wonderful sport.
That is suffering in America is baseball. It was much noted that in the World Series this year, there wasn't an African-American player. And that I don't off the top of my head know what attendance is, but it does seem to me like viewership and attendance is off, calculated as you will for the pandemic, but it's just down. You did find a poll. This is 5 years ago. In your piece, you said 37% of respondents said football is the sport they like to watch the most, 37%. That was equal to the combined percentage of the next five most popular sports: basketball 11, baseball 10, soccer 8, ice hockey, and auto racing with 4 each. And football is our passion, even if baseball is our pastime. Do you feel guilty at all when you watch football? Guilty is not the right word, but when I see somebody get a terrible injury, like who was it? Was it the Dolphins quarterback that was concussed in consecutive games? And I'm thinking, you know what? There's a lot of money in this sport. There's a lot of opportunity for young men to play the sport and get a lot of money. And the money comes from me. You know, I'm watching it on TV. I'm part of the money chain. And I feel, I don't know, some level of complicity in what I think is a sport that is almost too dangerous now.
Yeah, no, I see that, and I think that the violence in football is really a bug, not a feature, and that they should do everything they can to minimize it. Some of the rule changes they've made have been somewhat effective, but you're right. Every game, there's always at least few, maybe 4 or 5 stoppages of play when somebody's lying on the ground, badly hit, injured, sometimes season-ending, sometimes career-ending injuries that happen to people, and they really need to figure out a way, I think, to minimize that. It's definitely true. It still doesn't. It is. Anyone with a conscience has to feel that watching that sport, which is that it exploits those dreams that people have, and that it brutalizes people and damages their brains and so on. Same thing is true with boxing. There are also head injuries and concussions in soccer. Heading the ball. It's hard to reconcile that. It's hard to put that back all together.
Yeah, none more so than football. And would really feel a call of conscience would be if I had an 8-year-old who was fast and athletic and wanted to play football. I'll bet a lot of them do. Lord knows we didn't. We were kids. We played in the backyard and at school and stuff like that. I never played organized football until I was in high school, and then I was just a kicker. So what do I know? But I would feel really hard-pressed to let my 8-year-old play organized football. That'd be a tough one for me. Let's go to the mayoral race in Chicago. So are we done now? The field is set, right?
Well, it's not set. All the petitions were filed by yesterday. The deadline for petitions was yesterday, and 11 candidates filed petitions, including a guy named Johnny Logalbo. And I'd never heard of him. He was not on any list that I'd seen, but he filed petitions. He's a truck driver for the Chicago Department of Aviation, who describes himself as a, quote, freelance counselor, unquote. And he is one of the 11 who have filed. I'm guessing that of these 11, 8 are going to survive signature challenges and be on the ballot. I'm almost certain that Johnny Logalbo is not going to have 12,500 valid signatures. I'm guessing that Jamal Green, the activist who had trouble last time getting his petitions, probably won't have enough. I'm wondering whether Frederick Collins, the Chicago police officer who used to ran for Congress as a Republican a while back, will have enough signatures. But the rest, I think the field is going to be set with Brandon Johnson, the Democratic Cook County Commissioner, Chuy Garcia, the congressman from the and the former mayoral candidate, Paul Vallis, former Chicago Public Schools CEO, Cam Buckner, who's a Democratic state rep. He's chairman of the House Black Caucus, 6th Ward Alderman Roderick Sawyer, 4th Ward Alderman Sophia King, Willie Wilson, the entrepreneur, philanthropist, and, of course, the incumbent Lori Lightfoot. That looks to me like that's the probable field for the February election.
By the way, I want to mention this. Pete just handed me this. Alderman Hopkins in the second says he's assembled a team of election law experts and political volunteers to do a line-by-line look at the signatures that Lori Lightfoot filed. He said the fact that she filed at the last minute indicates a possible deficiency in the petitions. She stated that she filed on the last day 4 years ago, but she was an unknown challenger 4 years ago. She's the incumbent this time, and there's no other reason for filing on the last day that makes sense other than she needed that extra week to pad her numbers. Well, that would be embarrassing if she doesn't have 12,200 valid signatures or whatever it is.
Yeah, it would be. I find it unlikely. She filed more than 40,000 signatures, and I think that that's going to be enough. You need 12,500 valid ones, and the rule of thumb is you need at least twice as many signatures as the requirement because so many of them get knocked off. There are people who signed for more than one candidate who are no longer at the address that they said they were going to, or the people who just signed Mickey Mouse because they wanted the person who was passing the petition to go away. One of the things interesting to me about this field is that there is only one white candidate. And all those that I listed there, there's Paul Vallis is the only white candidate. And we've talked about this before, John. I don't know whether Chicagoans still vote on racial lines or not for mayor. They certainly did back in the early 80s when Harold Washington was the candidate and everyone was trying to line up various constituencies against him. But it's curious to me that so many of these candidates are either black or Latino.
Yeah.
And I just don't know how it's going to play. It's going to be a really interesting field.
I think it's also interesting if you just look at the leadership roles in Chicago and Cook County. I mean, how many of them are women and how many of them are women of color, right? Preckwinkle, Lightfoot, Arwoody, if you would, and Ngozi Ezike when she was a leader in the fight against COVID, Kim Fox. The list just goes on of women and women of color who have leadership roles in Chicago.
Right. City clerk and so on. So, yeah. So it's definitely voters have shown them more than willing to cross racial lines and gender lines to vote for the most qualified candidate. So I'm not sure that's going to play much of a role. Vallis is the one who really seems to me to be occupying that particular lane, though. He's a much more conservative candidate than he used to be. I mean, he ran with Pat Quinn. He was Pat Quinn's lieutenant governor candidate back, was it 6 years ago or something?
Hey, Eric, wait, I've got 20 seconds left. Do you think that gives him an advantage in trying to qualify for a runoff?
I hope not. That's all I'll say. I hope not. Nothing against Dallas, but I hope the people aren't voting that way.
So. I get your point then. Let's talk more about that on the Mincing Rascals podcast. We'll record it on Wednesday. It'll drop Wednesday afternoon. Eric, it's always good to read you in the Picayune Sentinel. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, John.